hello and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think.
The Thin Blue Mind, with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, hello to The Thin Blue Mind. This week we're going to be looking at the Race Action Plan, which has recently been published by the College of the Policing and National Police Chiefs Council. Before we start looking at that, Deputy Chief Constable Taryn Joyce posted an open letter, really, about why the plan needed to be put in place and some of its aims. And he went on to say that, "I believe there is an overwhelming acceptance within policing of the need for further change. This is not something that one person or group of any race or belief can achieve alone." And he goes on to say, "In 1999, I was a detective sergeant based at Brixton Police Station in the Met. I will never forget the moment that a senior officer addressed the team after the publication of the McPherson Inquiry. He stated that we must all accept that we are all institutionally racist with little further discussion. This triggered an emotive response of me. Did he just call me racist?" He then goes on to say that there are people both inside and outside of the service who feel that unless the police accept the service remains institutionally racist, this plan is doomed to failure. So the debate is clear. There is evidence of progress since the report's publication in 1999, which is the McPherson report, but is it enough for the police service to demonstrate this status no longer applies? You must move beyond words to action upon which the police service can be judged. So there we go, that's the police action race plan. Big topic, where do we start?
Well, first thing I would say is, and I think you touched on it there, and most cops on the ground would probably ask, is the report calling me racist?
Well, I think that's certainly when I was made aware of the report, I did feel a little bit aggrieved, to be honest with you. Felt exactly that reason. And obviously it was a feeling that was replicated back in 99 with the McPherson report.
The report thrust for me is it's not enough anymore for us to say that we are not a racist organisation. We've got to be saying that we're an anti-racist organisation. And we've already got some legal underpinning for that. We've got racially aggravated sentencing powers on various offences. If during the investigation we can show proof of racial aggravation, motivation by racism, that will potentially increase the sentence for a guilty offender. It kind of, I think, underpins, points up things that we should already be doing. We should be anti-racist. There's legislation there that we're tasked to enforce that has a racist element in the punitive part of it. It's also specifically about improving policing for black people. There are other ethnic and cultural minorities, but this action plan is specifically, explicitly about improving policing for black people. If you look at what's underpinned it, the introduction to the report mentions the murder of George Floyd in 2020, a murder that took place in America where officers have been convicted of the murder. And it makes reference to the McPherson report and the murder of Stephen Lawrence, which was nearly 30 years ago. We have come some way since then, but it seems that policing can't just be not racist. It has now to be anti-racist.
There's a lot of stats in the report, and quite rightly as well, to show that the lack of confidence that the black communities have in policing. More likely to be stopped, searched, more likely to be arrested, less likely to join the police, which to me points towards a cultural trust issue. I think we need to move away from having a subjective issue with the report personally and say, well, is this calling me racist? Or is this calling us, or me and my team, racist? No, we are police service, which is quite unique in the world, and we need to represent the communities we've served. I've said this on previous podcasts. And I think we need to move away from being shocked, hurt. People want scrutiny of the police. We apply force to people. We take people's liberties away. Therefore, we need to be completely open and transparent. And if one particular community doesn't have trust in the police service, We need to examine why, and we need to look at it objectively rather than subjectively.
Well, the report falls into two camps. It's the disparity and the treatment and victimisation, as the report labels it, of black heritage. And then obviously it's also looking at the treatment and recruitment of black people within the police service. So let's look at the first part of that report. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the George Floyd murder in America, how one incident by one police officer affected probably most of the police forces across the world.
That is a perfect example of social media. It was pretty much streamed live, or certainly near live, and you could watch somebody die at the hands of police using restraint techniques that shouldn't ever have been used, I would say. And it struck a chord with people. It was just horrible. I remember watching the video, can still remember it very, very well. It was watching a man die at the hands of a police force.
And I think we were all thinking the same thing while we were watching. It was, for God's sake, get off his neck.
Absolutely.
But of course, obviously, as a result of that incident, then people like Black Lives Matter came into existence. I mean, that's a whole other topic, but it just shows how impactful that incident was.
I think with the George Floyd, obviously the incident itself is shocking, and I agree with everything that you've said. But it only came to the fore once that video footage was released, and the police service themselves didn't actively go looking for that. That wasn't part of an investigation that they were trying to do. It was because of social media and the easy access of video to the masses. It just makes you think, well, how many other George Floyds have there been? And I think that's what the community are potentially have an issue with.
I mean, well, we will never know, will we, what the outcome of that incident would have been had there not been the video. But what you raised, Steve, is quite chilling.
Well, it is, and police service is quite unique, where one officer's actions in America, who get trained completely different, have a different set of standards, different ethics, different code of practice, etc., will affect a traffic officer in Lancashire, because the policing is quite a unique area of business, isn't it? And it's the one area, I think, which communities, if they lose, it sends a shudder down the spine, doesn't it?
I was looking through the report generally, and what does it suggest that we do? The thing that jumped out to me off the pages was that where there is a statistical disparity, where our use of powers is shown to disproportionately be used on the black community, that we should explain all reform in the face of that disparity. To my knowledge, for 25 years, we've been looking to try and explain that disparity. There's been all sorts of papers done. It's a happy hunting ground for people that want to do research. Mm-hmm. Why is it that black people are more searched, more stopped, more victims of crime, sort of serious violent crime? Why is it that that happens? Now, if there was a reasonable explanation for it, I would have thought in a quarter of a century we'd have got there already, but we haven't.
It's not an easy win, and I don't think you'll see the results for many years, for decades, because it's a trust issue and it's a cultural issue through the generations.
Well, the report says, when it cites its case for change, that black people are 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched than white people, 5 times more likely to be subject to the use of force. Testimony tells us that black people find these encounters, particularly stop and search, confrontational, stigmatising and humiliating. And just to the point you were raising, Steve, there is a trust deficit in the police amongst black communities. For example, confidence in the police is 20% lower in the black Caribbean group than the national average. Quite clearly, trust is a big issue and certainly part of the problem.
I'm not going to say that we've never had those issues, but you've got to look at the Met, I think, about why some of these issues are coming to the fore. And the concentration of the communities, the black communities within the London area, and how they feel that they're being policed. And I think that's where you start, don't you?
We have this thing with the big urban forces, stop and search. 2/3 of all the stop and search is in those big urban forces, the Londons, the West Midlands, the Greater Manchester, the West Yorkshire. And stop and search seems to be particularly corrosive.
You know, you raise an important point. I used to work in Blackpool, and there were less black heritage people and Asian people than perhaps, say, if I were to work over in the east of the county. So the dynamics of the way you police an area, I suppose, are going to be different.
One of the things that was meant to help post-McPherson was neighbourhood policing. There was a lot that was invested in neighbourhood policing to be that link between communities and the police service. But of course, as we know, we've now had a decade where we've retreated from the towns and the spread out across a city-type police station areas. We've retreated from neighbourhood policing under the demand of losing 20,000 cops. That's a real problem. You expect neighbourhood policing to take up that building bridges, and it's been a dwindling resource in many services, many police forces, rather than being that hope that was invested in it.
That is a really important point, isn't it? Because you're right, community policing, police being on the street, which is where we need to be. Not only are we not building trust with black heritage people, we're really not building trust with anybody at the moment.
Absolutely. It's policing from out-of-town industrial parks and policing by car, less and less foot patrol, and that foot patrol being curtailed by the fact you've now got travel time backwards and forwards. It's not been a good decade for neighbourhood policing.
And that's where community policing, sometimes you can't record some of the wins, that integration into those communities, the hello and the local youth club meeting and popping in, but also working with other partners, because this is just not a policing issue. The trust and the confidence of policing, it, like you said, Richard, it's not an easy win. If it was low-hanging fruit, it would have been sorted by now. Mm. But it goes all the way back to social care, formative years of people and, you know, not turning victims into offenders and social economic issues. And it can't just be policing.
I think it can be done. I compare and contrast with being a student in the 1980s in London. There was a thing there known as pretty policing. It's where the Met would put good-looking young male officers into public toilets and the like and go fishing for importuning-type offences. Obviously, that had a devastating effect on relationships with the gay community in London. They felt they were being persecuted and picked on, and I think there's a case to say that they were. And confidence in the police in that community was way, way down because they felt picked on. They felt they weren't getting a fair shake of the stick from policing. They felt that if there was gay bashing going on, they weren't getting their offences investigated properly. People weren't being brought to justice. Now you look at how far we have come since the 80s with LGBTQ issues, where we're now assessed by Stonewall as being one of the better employers in the country. If you're LGBTQ, I would say we've come a long, long way to mending bridges. And we've done the work in recruitment, we've done the work in being visibly supportive, we've done the work of having senior officers who are out and visible and happy to be visible and happy to be role models. We can do it.
The fine line to walk is improving the confidence of those communities, having an action plan like this and saying, listen, we do hear you, we do take you seriously, but we need to keep going with stop and search. We need to keep going with arresting offenders, whatever that may be. We will not have a hands-off approach because people are still carrying knives. Young black kids are still getting stabbed, whether that be from a white kid, a black kid, or whatever. We will still robustly target offenders because that's what we're here to do. But we have this plan and we are working on addressing some issues because we do not want a cop driving through an area, whatever, and not stopping somebody or not searching somebody purely because of the colour of their skin, because that flips it all on its head. If you were a young cop and you thought, I'm not even going to bother because it's just not worth the questioning, it's just not worth the hassle, it's not worth the complaint, I think we've got an issue. Because we represent those communities, we need those communities to be part of us. The black people are underrepresented in the police. We need to build those bridges. The first step in any of these plans is to get sign-off from some major community leaders in those communities. Action plans with you, signing them off, and then going out to bat for them in those communities. But with the understanding that we're still here to protect people and prevent crime.
Well, I'm just wondering whether this report might have the unintended consequence of doing exactly that to young police officers, where they will be scared to stop black or ethnic minority people.
Yeah, and I don't think it's just young. I think some experienced cops thinking, well, it's just not worth it. I've got enough time in the job to realise that I'm just not going to get, if I don't stop this person, no one's going to know, and I just won't get the questioning. It's not worth the hassle.
Before we move on to other topics within this report, we're all experienced police officers. What can we do to improve the trust with our black communities?
I think internally, although there's been heroic efforts to increase recruitment, it hasn't been massively successful. Black people are still underrepresented in recruitment. There's still some idea that they don't get as far at the promotion ladder as their white counterparts, and they retire earlier than their white counterparts. If we talk about that, the police are the people are the police, it would help if we perhaps looked more like the communities that we serve. Not a perfect solution, and it can be difficult for officers that join the police service from minority ethnic communities. I've seen it myself with officers from the Asian community in Blackburn, where I worked, coming under some pressure from within their own community for the decision they made to join the police. It's not always universally welcomed, not seen as a high status occupation in some parts of the community. It's difficult for them.
Personally, forget the percentages for 10 years. Let's not measure the percentage-wise of Black, Asian, Gypsy, underrepresented groups within the police for 10 years. Because, like in the police, we'll always chase percentages looking for the easy win. We're having people coming into the police service from these backgrounds and they're not being supported within their own community. We've got it back to front. You need to spend the next 5-10 years just getting into those communities and getting their trust. Because without that, you're not going to get that easy flow of officers in. And I think you're going to unlock a lot of gates and doors that are blockers for people joining.
And we have that already. We have the Independence Advisors Group. We have those links already made in the community. I think one of the things that comes out from the Race Action Plan for me, which is great, is there's been an independent scrutiny board looking at how the plan works out. And I think the people on that board have been picked to be critical friends and to ask awkward questions. Hopefully that voice isn't silenced, isn't buried in the day-to-day media scrum. I suspect if they're critical of policing, that will get into the news. But they've been picked specifically, I think, to be a challenging group of people for us. And that can't be a bad thing. There's a recommendation that officers understand the history of the policing of Black people. And I can foresee course industry coming in around this, as it did post-McPherson. And what I would hope doesn't happen, we have previously hired in just generic trainers to deliver a generic course, not specialists in the area, not people with credibility in the area. I remember a course I went on which was extremely awkward for the trainer. They were just there because they could deliver courses, not because they had any special insights. And they went around the room. I, at that time, was a Home Office-funded hate crime detective. There were 3 or 4 senior Asian officers in the audience. Collectively in there, we probably had better appreciation of the issues than the trainer that was trying to deliver the course. And the trainer made the great mistake of saying, the Asian community, at which 2 of the officers in the room were, what do you mean, the Asian community? We're not a monolithic block. How are you standing there delivering us training when you don't actually have any sophisticated understanding of what's going on? So I hope that if we do this sort of training, we get people that have some credibility delivering it, that have some knowledge that are delivering it, and we don't fall back on going to a big public service company and getting a block of generic training.
I think this action plan perhaps addresses the symptom and not the problem. We've all highlighted it, hasn't it, that in the last 10 years has not been a good decade for policing, and community policing is just, personally, it's just gone out the window now. And unless you're on the street, you're never going to get trust. I use the analogy, you can't do house-to-house inquiries on a computer. You've got to be on the street and you've got to be mixing with the communities and you're going to be part of it.
There's no substitute for Mark 1 boot leather, quite right.
Okay, right. Well, there's other topics to look at. It's a big, big subject. And before we move on to our Black colleagues and retention within the police, I was just looking through the report and it says the Black men are over 3 times as likely to be arrested than white men, with 60 arrests per 1,000 Black men compared with 17 for white. And it goes on to say in the 3 years to the year ending March 2021, the average homicide rate for Black people was about 6 times higher than for white people and almost 4 times higher than victims of other ethnicities. What it doesn't make clear is the heritage of the perpetrator. I can't see anywhere in this report which highlights that. It's an uncomfortable truth that certainly within the London area, a lot of violent crime is black on black.
Yeah, and this is the reason why we have to stand our ground. This is the reason why, as the police service, we have to be open and honest and say we are still going to detect crime, because we are actually serving your community by preventing you becoming victims and victims becoming offenders. Is it an omission? I know the stats are out there somewhere.
I find it troubling. There's certainly issues, and as police, we're not dealing with them very well, I would suspect. If the likelihood of you being a victim of serious violent crime is greater because of your ethnicity, that's something we should be working on ceaselessly, remorselessly, to bring down that risk of being a victim of serious violent crime because of the colour of your skin.
Even if it means disproportionately stopping Black people?
Even if it means disproportionately putting boots on the ground in particular areas at particular times when our intelligence, our recording systems tell us that there is a greater likelihood of people being out armed and out committing serious violent crime. And there's that thing about explain the disparity as part of the plan. We explain the disparity by saying we have to put the oil to the squeak, so to speak. We've got limited resources. We are deploying additional resources into this area or that area because there's a lot of violent crime going on there. We're doing it to help protect the community, to save lives, to save people from injury. This area will be more strongly policed because look us in the eye and tell us that there aren't problems here.
We're really bad at explaining why we do something, aren't we?
We don't explain enough, no.
It's going to take a long time. And can the action plan, can it wait? No, it can't. How are we going to do it? You can't stop servicing grade one emergency demand by putting grade one leather in a certain estate. Got to find a happy medium for it. And it's going to take people, it's going to take resources, and it's going to take time.
Peter Hitchens, who is a very experienced journalist, to be fair, but a lot of people find him Marmite, and he argues the fact that we've got more police now than we did, and we're not doing our job. And I have a sort of sympathy with his view, because if we just purely dealt with what we should be doing, which is crime and community, then we have got enough police officers. But unfortunately, most of our time is spent up with other issues. I think 80% is non-crime related, I think I read somewhere. We've got to get back into the community, haven't we? And I don't think we're there.
We're not. And the other issue with community is nobody sticks around very long anymore. And the days when you had your known community beat officers and they'd be there for 5, 10, 15 years, they're gone. Neighbourhood is somewhere that people pass through now on the way to somewhere else.
It's a rung on that promotion ladder, isn't it? To tick the box.
Or on lateral promotion, as they call it, to somewhere else. CID or traffic or firearms or whatever. But it's not seen as a long-term career option for a lot of officers now.
There seems to be a perception, doesn't there? Like, I certainly remember when I joined the cops that there was that expectation that you'd put your big hat on and you'd get out on the street. And I loved it. I love talking to people and being nosy, and you find out so much just by speaking with people. But not only does that not happen now, is that cops don't seem to want to do that.
No, I don't think the lights are brighter elsewhere, if you will.
We haven't got the resources to go back to Dixon of Dot Green era. We just don't have it. And I go back to, it's wider than the police. It's a socio-economic issue, which is going to take many years. And we're going to have to look at it from a multi-service aspect.
It's proper explanation. I think it's saying, here's 20 things that we might do. These are the 10 that we want to do, and here's why we want to do them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you'll find that a lot of the vulnerability stuff will come away. And that's even more prevalent in the black communities and the gypsy community and the Asian community, and because they'll have a different set of 10 things they want us to look at than others.
But there has to be a space for professional police judgment. That's, you know, what we're trusted with. And so we should have a strong voice on what we think we ought to be doing. We shouldn't be blind to people saying, no, you're wrong because. But we should be very open about setting out what is our agenda, what are we concentrating on, and being really, really open and really vocal about that and why we're doing it and why we're not doing other things.
Well, one of the main thrusts of the report is the zero tolerance of racism in policing. I can't think in the 25 years I was a cop, I have seen any racism towards colleagues. I've seen one instance of racism towards a colleague from a member of the public.
I can think of things from 40 years ago that have been reported to me, but during the course of my service, the same.
No, and I'm quite confident that anybody I knew worked with in the police would call it out. But it's the perception, and this is, again, it's not what we think, it's what the communities think, how they think we police, and what our mindsets are. And you bring them in, make them part of the daily business, they'll see what we're like.
There's racism towards the public by the police, and then there's racism towards our colleagues by the police. There's two separate areas there.
I've seen racism towards Asian colleagues by members of the public. Definitely seen that happen, racism towards Asian colleagues by members of the public.
But never in the police to each other or a member of the public, never, hand on heart, in my 27 years, never.
I think things are different now, but I remember a conversation we had in the last podcast about WhatsApp groups and awkward conversations, perhaps people saying things they shouldn't. And I know one of you said, like, oh, well, you get up and walk out of the canteen because you didn't want to hear it. And I still think that is a problem in the police. I think a lot of people, you say that people would call it out. I would hope that they would. I suspect a lot of people would rather just walk away and didn't hear it so they don't have to report it. And that is down to the organisation, I think, the way it deals with these complaints, because not everybody has had a good experience from being a whistleblower, want of a better word.
No, I think something so egregious as racism, I disagree with you, Dave. I think it would get called out instantly.
I think now it would, but I'm not saying it always has been.
No, no.
And that's not to say the officers that didn't call it out were racist, but it's the old saying, isn't it? You know, evil succeeds when good men do nothing. Mm. And I think that's been half the problem with the police in the past.
You look at the cultural change in policing from when we started to where we are now. I think it may be summed up as an old boss of mine was having a chat one early morning. But you know what, Richard? When I joined the police, it wasn't as right-wing as I thought it would be. And I think that's probably right.
Yeah.
I think culturally, politically, in groups, you know, the terms of the sort of people that are in policing, we've changed culturally beyond recognition from where we were 30 years ago. Just look simply at the number of women in policing. What this report is saying to us is that, yeah, you've improved perhaps, but you ain't there yet. There's a way to go. There's work to do. This is the work. Whether it's right or not, whether that work is actually effective in addressing those disparities or explaining those disparities. And I hope when they are explainable, nobody shies away from explaining them.
It's explaining the negatives, isn't it? It's explaining why we are doing the things that I mentioned on this report and why we, for the short term, have to keep on doing it.
Yeah, whenever there's a discussion, we get back to the raw stats. Nobody wants to explain anything. Nobody wants to give reasons and evidence. Everybody just wants to look at the raw stats and say, this percent this percent that, and draw conclusions from that without looking at anything that resembles evidence.
It's a lot more nuanced than that, as you said before.
Well, before we go on to recruitment, regarding the police service for black and other heritage areas, it's only fair we look at probably the most tragic area of the report is knife crime. We can't fail to be moved by the sheer volume of knife crime and also the ages of not only the victims but the perpetrators. We're talking about children now, and it goes far beyond policing. It's a community issue, isn't it?
Well, knife crime begets knife crime. If you think you're likely to be a victim of knife crime, you're going to carry a knife.
And the knives are available. You look at these sort of Anglo Arms knives that keep turning up, same zombie killer type knives. Remember an inspector of mine when I was on licensing saying, can we do anything about, you know, the army surplus shops selling machetes and the like? Logged him onto Amazon and showed him how easy it was to buy a bush knife or a zombie killer knife. And he appreciated the problem that it wasn't people going round to the army surplus store and buying an old machete from 1950s Burma. It was people going on to Amazon or online generally.
Well, again, it comes back to cultural, doesn't it? It comes back to why are people feeling the need to carry knives. I just think to tackle something like that, and you need to flood, and you just need to smash it apart. And you're going to do that by interacting with people, stopping and searching when necessary. And if that's predominantly black people, well, so be it, because people's lives are at risk here.
And building the intelligence so that you have names, streets, areas, groups that you know, because people are telling you, are carrying weapons of one sort or another. If you don't have that information, because you haven't got those links into the community, you haven't got that trust, you haven't got those boots on the ground, you're fighting with one hand tied behind your back, never just quite knowing who's doing what.
And you only get that intelligence by being out there.
Absolutely.
Stop check isn't the deterrent. It's the probability of being stop checked is the deterrent, isn't it? And like you say, I completely agree. You need to be consistent. You need to keep driving it. It can't be we're having an action crime week this week on this area. And we can't keep doing it as a response to a serious incident that's occurred. So someone gets hurt, someone gets injured, and suddenly there's a Section 60 search, which means you can search anybody without any grounds, is applied to a certain area and you quell the disorder. That's not the way. That's the reactive. We need to be proactive, like you say.
Well, I mean, we talk about partnerships in the police a lot, don't we? I don't agree with that. I don't think it's partnerships. I think it's relationships. Let's look at the problem of recruitment of black people into the police service. I know compared to other organisations, we are well below the levels that other organisations recruit. Why do we think that is?
It's a symptom, I think, for the wider issue. We're focusing again too much on a symptom of the problem. Have as many action days as you want. You can have as many taster sessions as you want for people from these communities. Short-term hits to try and get that percentage up, but it comes down to cultural. It comes down to whether you're supported by your family, whether you're supported by a community leader, and it comes down to that community supporting its community. We're not going to get that when the other factors are saying that people don't have confidence in the police, so therefore they're not going to want to join, and they're not going to support their siblings or other community members from joining.
I think there's a feeling also that the people still talk about canteen culture, though we haven't really had canteens for a long, long time. There's a feeling that the culture inside the police, you'll have to change yourself to fit in with it. You'll have to be a different person. It's not true. You can absolutely be yourself within policing. We're a very broad church. Lots of different types of personality, cultural backgrounds. But I think there's that feeling that you have to subsume yourself to policing to be part of this sort of monolithic block of policing culture.
Well, there's two things there, and I remember at my final interview, one of the questions was I was asked, trying to get in, was how do you think you'll fit into the police? And I think I gave the answer as well. Actually, it's your values that fit in with mine, not the other way around. But I'll use an example. And isn't it strange how the reputation of an organisation is wholly dependent on one person? I remember first week in, and all new recruits, about seven of us in division, one of the detectives from CID spent most of the morning explaining how CID isn't the department we thought it was, and all the preconceptions, and how liberated it was, and how open, and all the rest of it. And then at dinner time, we went into the canteen, table full of detectives, and all they were doing was basically taking the mic all out of us, and we overheard this, and that entire morning was just wasted. And the point I'm making, I suppose, is the organisation can do everything it can, but if just one person goes against that, then that experience for that black officer or Asian officer is ruined, and they will tell their mates, and we've gone back 30 years, I suppose, in the space of a minute.
And it would probably land harder on the Asian black officer, who's quite sensitive and quite alive to the cultural issues within policing. It would land harder on them than it would you or I, as a white officer, getting the mick taken out of you by a white detective.
I think some parts of black community, policing is seen as a white person's occupation. There's this horrible racial slur that gets thrown at some black police officers, coconut. Mm. Black on the outside, white on the inside. Horrible, horrible thing to say about somebody, but there is that perception. Policing is a white person's game. They're so white, so many of us. It's not something that black people should get themselves involved with. Not for them.
From
do
whom?
Something else. From within the community.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I don't have that black experience. I'm not black, but I do wonder, perhaps not this generation, but the previous one, where siblings or children will want to join the police, but their parents will have had a different experience. There's conflict then, aren't they, of, as you say, from the community. And I've heard stories from black officers, not personally, but things I've seen in the news media, how most of the, and it is racism, is from their black community members. Why they shouldn't be in the police and labelled a traitor. And that's a form of racism in itself.
I've seen it happen to Asian officers. Pro-Palestinian demo in Blackburn. And my Asian colleague was surrounded and berated by other Asian men saying, why have you joined the police? It's a kuffar occupation. You can't be Asian and be in the police. There's certainly a cultural thing going on there. It was somehow wrong to join the police. We work hard to overcome that, and I know in Lancashire we do a lot to support people trying to come into policing from minority communities, because we think that having that greater diversity, having that better representation will be good for us as an organisation. So the work's getting done. Issue would be, with all the work that has been done, why are black people still underrepresented in recruitment? Why are they not doing as well in promotion? And why are they leaving earlier? I don't know the answers to those, I have to say, but it's a thing. The stat is there. It needs explaining. And if it can be addressed, it needs addressing.
It's confidence from their community. If the community have no confidence in us, we're not going to get the representation.
Well, we started this podcast, didn't we, saying that nobody really knows why we have these issues that we do. Nobody can actually tell us. And 30 years on, we're still in the same position. I'm going to use the P word now, and that's politics. It's a word I hate to use. We've all talked about this being a generational thing, and unfortunately in politics, the government of the day don't have a generation. They have 5 years in Parliament, and if they can't be seen to have sorted a problem out, then they have failed, at least in their electorate's eyes. Some problems cannot be sorted in 5 years, and I think that's just going to be the circle that we're stuck in. And until somebody has the courage, I suppose, to say, I'm going to put something in motion, but I won't see the results of it and I won't get the credit for it. Until that happens, I think we're going to keep revolving around the same problem, unfortunately.
I think there's a role for somebody somewhere to do a collection and a massive literature review, all the research in this area for the UK. And I say the UK. McPherson tells me something about how policing was a quarter of a century ago, and it tells me something that's applicable to UK policing. George Floyd, I don't think to the same extent informs my appreciation of what's happening with UK policing. My concern is that there is so much research that has been done to look at those disparities, to research those disparities. Let's clear the ground from under our feet. Let's know the whole body of research that's available and start to maybe try and draw some conclusions from that. I'm not sure that work's ever been done. Or if it has been done, it's been lost somewhere in the mists of time. But I know the research has been done. And I know lots of people have researched it. But I'm not sure that anybody, College of Policing would seem to be an ideal place for this to happen, has gathered it together and critically considered it and looked at, do we have some of the answers or some of the explanations to hand already?
And perhaps some of that research that's out there doesn't really say what the reader would wish it to.
Absolutely.
What I will say is it's a wider community issue, and the police are seen as agents of the state in many eyes, as the enforcers. And I think the state itself and politics and the current government and previous governments have not supported these communities, and they are undervalued and under investment into these communities. And the frustrations against the state are shown towards the police when policing is trying to fairly police.
I will bet a good round of coffee, which is my customary bet, that if you were to take a heat map of poverty and deprivation, it would overlay very well with a heat map of serious violent crime.
The Thin Blue Mind, with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, that concludes this week's discussion. I'm sure you'll agree there's a lot to think about. Steve Bradshaw now continues his regular feature with the Acting Inspector.
The Acting Inspector with Stephen Bradshaw.
I think as serving or recently retired police officers, one thing that we all have an opinion on is the portrayal of police service and police officers on TV and film. Are there shows that you just won't watch because it's inaccurate, or do you find yourself shouting at the TV about a certain scene, etc., that portrays police officers? I've been acting now for about 4 or 5 years, and I've been very lucky enough to be on quite a few sets of soaps and dramas that are filmed in the Northwest. So as a recently retired police officer, I'm in a quite a unique position to be able to appreciate both sides of the coin, really, to understand what goes on a set, but also have the policing experience behind me to be able to give some credible advice. And what I've noticed very quickly is that it is an area of growth, and it's not something that is used a lot. Some production companies are really, really hot on it, and some production companies hire police advisors right at the script writing stage. So you can see that there has been some police advice and some police input at a very early stage. Others do that as well as have someone come up on set and give the advice at the time to the actors or to the director or even to the prop people or makeup, etc. I think the whole cast and crew get a lot of benefit from having a police advisor on set. One of the issues I see people have is that things are still not accurate. But what you think you need to appreciate is that people are trying to create a drama. People are trying to create something which people will watch. And I always say, if you want it 100% accurate, if you want to make a documentary about the day in the life of the police officer, it's not going to be interesting to watch a cop on hold to CPS for half an hour, or on a bed watch, or a constant supervision in custody. You need to find that sweet spot between a drama and it being interesting and the accuracy of it. And I think a police advisor to a director or a producer or a writer needs to think of themselves as kind of a tactical advisor, where you will say, well, this is the way it would happen. This is what would happen in real life. This is the way those four people would stack on that door to go and do that emergency search tactic. And then the director, who has 100 different influences that are playing on him or her, who will then mould that tactical advice into what they are doing. So you might find that some aspects of it are used, all of it's used, or very minimal. It depends on the scene, and it depends on what the scene is trying to do to push the story forward. But there's also a fine line for the actual advisor to walk as well. You want it to look realistic. You want it to look like it would do on the street. But what you don't want to do is to give away tactics, because the tactics directory, especially in armed policing, is not for public consumption. So you need it to look like it's right without going through the exact tactic with everyone. It seems a little bit daft, that. So how can it be accurate if you're not going to do the most up-to-date tactic? Well, there's only so many ways you can, for example, enter a door. And especially in the armed policing world, it's just how people look is the first step. Because I've seen some dramas myself where it portrays AFOs or SFOs sometimes as well. And it's just the way, little things like the way the ammunition is being carried. The magazines are the wrong way around in the mag pouches. Little things like that. And I think a hands-on police advisor is invaluable in getting a team of people together who are experienced in the acting world in performing the role of AFO stroke SFO, and being able to look the part as well as implement the tactic correctly. The basics of weapon handling and blue on blue and not sweeping somebody during an entry to a door, that can be the parts of which you can have a really big effect on. And it looks better for it. And anyone looking at it will see that it looks about right because they looked the part. And if it's right to the cops, if it's right to a firearms officer, it's going to look right to the public. And I think that's the benchmark a lot of people are striving for. So it's not necessarily the action of the tactic which is moulded by the director. It can actually start with just looking the part and look like you're an AFO stroke SFO.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time and the next podcast, take care.